Have you protected yourself against pregnancy? You know, when they're talking about contraception. So pregnancy is some sort of disease that needs to be protected from. We're encouraging people to look at pregnancy and children in a negative light.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello and welcome to The Profile. This is Premier Christian Radio and I am Emma Fowle. The Profile is brought to you in association with Premier Christianity, the UK's leading Christian magazine. Head over to premierchristianity.com/podcast for your exclusive half-price subscription offer. Today I am joined on The Profile by Isabel Vaughan Spruce, the director of March for Life UK and 40 Days for Life. This year, Isabel has been arrested twice. Not what you might be expecting to hear on a Christian podcast. And her crime? Praying. In a public place. Specifically within 150 metres of an abortion centre. In this episode of the podcast, Isabel explains what the introduction of buffer zones in the UK mean for freedom of expression and belief, and why she won't stop trying to broker a more honest conversation about the impacts of abortion for everyone involved. Well, let's start, if you don't mind, Isabel, with a bit of your own story. How were you brought up? Have you always been a Christian? Did you find faith at some point? And how did you come to the point where you were like, this is my calling, I need to get involved with this issue?
So, yeah, I was brought up in a Christian household, thankfully, and I'm very grateful to my parents. Particularly my dad had a very strong faith, and, you know, very pro-life and in every sense of the word. So, for example, when I was young, we lived in a big four-story house up on the hills, and I'm one of six. I remember us six children shared one bedroom, and the rest of the house was given to what were called the guests. So, for example, there was a local psychiatric hospital. Well, it was called a hospital, but it was more of a community where adults with severe mental health problems, they lived there, and there was everything there that they needed. So it was people with severe schizophrenia or bipolar or manic depression and things like that. And it closed down, and these people were sent to live out in the community, and they just couldn't cope. They'd never lived that way before. And so my dad opened our home, and many of those people came to live with us, as well as people who'd maybe been on the streets or people who just fallen in difficult times and didn't have anywhere else to go. Obviously, to some degree, he would vet them first. But it was a great time for them. I mean, I remember some would stay with us for weeks, some for years. But afterwards, when I would meet them in the street, they would say to me, that was the best time of my life. You know, they were just part of a family. And also, it was so good for us children growing up, because I think it helped us to see people and their value for who they are rather than what they can or can't do. You know, some of these people, my dad had to teach how to wash a shirt or boil an egg. You know, they couldn't really do anything that they needed to do to start with. But they were still incredibly valuable. And I think me seeing as a younger child how much value my dad recognised in them, that kind of helped develop something in me where I realised the importance of each and every person and what they contribute to society, not just because of what they do. And so I think that was a really great lesson in life, as well as just a general example, you know, in my family life growing up.
Well, that's a really full-on thing. Like, that's a very particular way to live. Did your parents work? Was that their full-time job, just opening your house to the community?
No, sadly, it didn't bring in any money. It wasn't something that they were paid to do. So my dad also had to, you know, he tried to buy and sell property and refurnished property and did all sorts of other things to try and raise money on the side, which, you know, this was kind of more his ministry. He'd had a very challenging childhood himself, been brought up in different homes, had a very difficult life. And I think it gave him a heart for the underdog. Yeah. And anyone who he saw who was maybe struggling, he really kind of empathized with and had a very deep heart. I mean, he was a convert to Christianity himself in his teens. And you could see it was really lived out in his life. And as a child, I maybe wasn't so aware of it. You know, your parents are just who they are. But looking back, I realised what an amazing example he was. And you know, obviously, like anyone else, he had flaws. He, you know, but at the same time, he really set a great example of how to try and live out your faith in your life. And particularly for, as I say, a child growing up, I think it was a really good example for me.
And was there a point that you committed your own life to Christ, or was it just something that was always there for you?
So I think the short answer is it was something much more gradual. I've never felt I didn't know Christ. Jesus has always been part of my life, and I think that's just an incredible grace and blessing that I've received. I suppose, certainly in my childhood, you remember times when you had to sort of make that effort to talk to God yourself. It wasn't, we did have times we'd pray as a family, but in those times I might well be distracted and not really be thinking about what I was supposed to be. But it was like I wanted to talk to God myself, but I think maybe in my teenage years was when I maybe took ownership of it more, as is maybe quite common with people. That's the time when you sort of find out who you are, when you either leave your faith or you really get affirmed in what you believe. And I used to love reading war stories, maybe particularly of the Second World War, but lots of periods in history where there were wars. And you'd see the kind of depths of evil that humanity would sink to, but you'd see heroism at its finest. And when you're reading a book and you sort of place yourself in those situations and you think, what would I have done if I'd lived back then? Would I have had the courage to do anything or say anything? And I gradually began to realize that was the wrong question, that it's not like, what would I have done back then? But there is a battle going on now, certainly from a spiritual perspective. And what am I doing about it? I can't just live with my head in a book or looking back to the past. It's like there's a battle for every age, and certainly a spiritual battle for every age. And so I began to kind of like look for ways to kind of live that out in my life, and how could I do that in terms of my prayer life, but in terms of practically what I could do as well, recognizing the physical battle that was going on, in as much as there was a swathe of society that was being treated as and regarded as, less valuable, in terms of their humanity.
And is that what led you to first get involved with the pro-life movement?
Yes, so as I say, I can never remember not being pro-life. I think it's a kind of natural thing that a child recognizes the value of little children. So unless you're taught otherwise, and I was never taught to dehumanize the pre-born child, I think it's something that is a very natural progression of that, humans having compassion for others. But yeah, it was probably in my teenage years I really began to be awakened to the fact that, this is something that's legal in our society. This is happening. What can I do about it? What's my part to play in it? And to start with, it would have obviously been prayer. It would have been financially supporting other organizations. But I really felt that wasn't enough, that I needed to actually do something myself. And to start with, I wasn't sure what that was. And then I remember one day I picked up a magazine called the Crusader Magazine, which is a magazine started by Maximilian Kolbe, who was a priest who was killed in Auschwitz, who gave his life for another condemned man. And obviously, prior to him going into that concentration camp, he'd started a magazine called the Crusader Magazine. And I'm not sure if it's still going today, but I remember back then picking up a copy of it, and it had like a letters page. And I remember reading a letter in there from a woman who talked about how she went to pray outside an abortion centre. And crucially, she'd left a phone number. And I guess it just stirred something in me. I thought, that's something I'd like to give a try, and I remember talking to my sister and brother, my older sister and younger brother. They were interested as well. So I phoned up this lady and found out where the nearest abortion centre to me was, where there was a few people, just a handful of people who'd pray for an hour on a Saturday. And I thought, well, I'll go and join them and sort of see what this is about. And that was kind of my first initiation, I guess, into practically doing something myself that was pro-life.
And what is it about actually physically being present outside of an abortion centre praying that you feel is important? Because I know I've spoken to a number of Christians who would consider themselves to be pro-life or to be anti-abortion either, who would say, but I wouldn't do that. I do agree that some people might perceive that as intimidating or upsetting, and I don't understand why Christians feel like they have to go and do that activity in that location. God can work anywhere. you know, we can pray quietly in our homes, whatever. So what is it that you feel is important about physically being present there?
I think there's a few ways of looking at this. And obviously there's, the fact that if we recognise the humanity of the preborn child and they are being aborted, then if we can go to offer another alternative to that woman, it might help that child to be saved from abortion. That's one way of looking at it. And I have to say, that was certainly something that spurred me on to start with, that injustice to the preborn child. The more I went, I also recognised how damaging abortion was to women. And to be able to offer alternatives to women became very important to me, because I, you know, you'd see them coming out of the abortion centre and being sick in the gutter and sobbing into their phones. And sometimes the same man coming back week after week with different women who clearly didn't seem to be having much of a choice in what they were doing. You'd see 14-year-olds being frog marched in there, and you thought, this isn't pro-woman. So it also became, you know, more and more apparent to me of how damaging it was to women. But then also there's another element to it. You know, that's maybe looking at more of a results-driven perspective. Like, you know, we might be able to help a woman to choose life, you know, or even if she's already made that decision, we might be able to help her to look at some healing afterwards, after she's had that abortion. But then I think from a faith perspective, obviously as a Christian, I often meditate on the passion of Christ, of his suffering and his death. And when you look at Jesus on the cross, I think a great thing for us to do as Christians is to look at how did Mary behave when her son was being crucified. Now, she could have just stayed at home and thought about that, or she could have gone to the synagogue, the temple, and prayed there. But she actually came out publicly and stood at the foot of the cross, and prayed there, and was with her son united there. And she wasn't, as far as we know, remonstrating with soldiers or physically trying to stop that. She seemed to accept God's will in what was happening, and was just there present. And I think that's an incredible example for us, that even if we aren't actually engaging in conversation or talking to people, just being there is an incredibly important thing, because I see abortion centres as the modern day Calvary. That is where innocents are being put to death legally, just as what was happening 2000 years ago when the most innocent person ever was put to death. We are seeing now today little children being put to death, sanctioned by our government. And even in a situation where we might not be able to engage with somebody and try and prevent this happening, I think just being there physically as a Christian is a very, very important thing. I think certainly very spiritually significant to us. Yes, we can pray anywhere. And of course, we can pray in our churches, in our houses, in the city centres, wherever. But actually being somewhere is important. Place is important to Christians. And it certainly was important 2000 years ago. And I think it's just as important today to be there where that act is actually happening.
And for you, that has actually been incredibly costly in recent months since the introduction of buffer zones around abortion centres. So for people who might be listening that don't know what those are, correct me if I get any of this wrong, because you're the expert in this area. But a few years ago, Bournemouth Council introduced a 150-metre zone around their abortion centre where people were not allowed to go and do certain activities, which included silent prayer, included standing, gathering, holding up leaflets or signs, or many other things that lots of Christians have been doing outside abortion centres. And now that is a national thing that is around all abortion centres, and that can be invoked in various ways, and you have been arrested twice so far for praying silently outside an abortion centre in Birmingham. Is that correct?
It is, yes. And like you explained to start with, it was just a kind of local law that police and council worked together to bring in. And originally those laws were meant for things like, you know, dog fouling or drunk and disorderly behaviour, so that local councils could maybe prevent dogs going into parks or whatever it might be. But they then started using that to try and create zones around abortion centres to stop people protesting in those zones. And like you say, at the end of October this year, it actually became a national law. But I think, you know, looking at those, it was called a PSPO before the National Buffer Zones came in, Public Space Protection Order. The buffer zones created by the PSPOs, the one in Birmingham, it banned protest. And actually, I maintain that I don't go to abortion centres to protest. In fact, I don't really know anyone in this country who does go and protest outside abortion centres on a regular basis. You know, the groups that I know who go to abortion centres go there, you know, in the past, they've gone to pray and to offer help and alternatives, but not really to protest. So obviously my reasoning was that if it's banning protest, well, that's not what I'm doing. I'm going there to pray, you know, primarily. So I'm at least able to go and do that. And so that's what, you know, I did go and do. My volunteers, as part of 40 Days for Life, which is an international movement where people go and pray near abortion centres. My volunteers who were part of 40 Days for Life, they actually stayed outside the buffer zone, but I went to pray inside it. And I should just say maybe that it's also good to be aware that these buffer zones were brought in off the back of a lot of gossip and hearsay that's been repeated and shared, particularly by the media. I mean, when I first started going outside this abortion centre in Birmingham, although I've been praying for about 20 years, this particular abortion centre we've only started praying outside of in 2020, we never had any posters whatsoever. It was just two people standing there quietly, you know, either saying some prayers or with some leaflets that offered help. And we just say to women, is there any help we can offer you, or would you like a leaflet? As they went in, and they were free to accept that or not as they wished. I mean, we know many women who accepted that help and were very grateful for being able to continue a much wanted pregnancy. But us standing there as pro-lifers, we actually received quite a lot of abuse, not from people using the abortion centre, not from the staff, but from locals in the area who had a different ideology. So we would be spat at and sworn at and have our property stolen. We were physically assaulted at times. And when we would talk to the police about this and why they weren't doing anything, even when we could show them video footage of us being assaulted, they said, well, if you don't want to be assaulted, you don't have to come out of your house, do you? So it was very difficult to get justice for us. And the local council would actually share things like, oh, crime has increased in the area since these people have moved in. And the police even admit that. Well, it had, but we were the victims. And it was decided in the end, it was just easier to try and move us out of the way than actually deal with the real problem, which was obviously some very intolerant locals. And even when my volunteers moved outside of the buffer zone, which actually was standing outside a local church, 150 metres away from the abortion centre, they were still victims of abuse. So they were still sworn at and spat at and physically assaulted and threatened and all that, you know, even though they were nowhere near the abortion centre. So you could see it wasn't really a case that people were worried about women being intimidated or harassed. That was never happening. It was more a sense of people being very intolerant and having a different ideology to the Christians who wanted to pray on the street.
It's very interesting because it different context, but bears lots of similarities to testimony that I've heard from Hatun Tash. I don't know if you know her. She's a Muslim convert to Christianity who shares a testimony quite often at Hyde Park at Speaker's Corner, and has said really similar things on many, many occasions. She's been assaulted. She was stabbed. Someone's actually been sentenced to a long time in prison for stabbing her. And yet most of the time, the police basically said, well, you're putting yourself at risk by being here and saying these things. You're the problem, basically, rather than dealing with the aggression that was coming towards her, which seems terribly unjust and very unfair. And when I'm listening to you, I'm hearing echoes of those stories. So what you're basically saying is that the women going to the centre and the staff, they didn't have a problem with you being there.
That would be a different thing to say. I would think the staff definitely didn't want us there, or certainly some of the staff who I'd spoke to didn't want me there. Actually, there were some members of staff who were actually very friendly towards me, but there were some there who didn't want us there. But they wouldn't be coming out and threatening us and abusing us. It was you know, like I say, some of the locals and passers-by who would be doing that.
And so are your group still there just outside the buffer zone?
Yeah, so we have... Twice a year, we hold a 40 Days for Life campaign. So once during the period of Lent leading up to Easter, and then again in the autumn. And during those time, for 40 consecutive days, the volunteers would be there from 8 in the morning till 8 in the evening, every day of the week for 40 days. And they wouldn't stand in big groups. Like I say, they'd be in twos or threes and just standing there saying some prayers. Now that we're so much further away from the abortion centre, right down the end of the street, we do just have a poster with us that says, you know, pregnant, need help, and a telephone number. It doesn't even mention abortion. And yet we've had locals coming up to us saying, you know, this is a terrible thing for children to have to see your poster. You're destroying the innocence of children. And yet it just says pregnant, need help. You know, we can see that they're really trying to kind of find reasons to try and get rid of us, basically, because they don't want us there.
So tell us a little bit about your recent experiences. You were arrested, you went to court, and you recently were the police made a settlement with you for wrongful arrest. So tell us about that and what that says to the wider legal situation in the UK now, because other people have also been arrested and the outcome hasn't been the same, has it?
Yeah, so as I say, when the buffer zone, the local buffer zone, you know, created by the PSPO came into effect in Birmingham, even though my volunteers prayed outside, I reasoned that I would be allowed to go and just pray outside the abortion centre. And I actually went inside the buffer zone when the abortion centre was closed and just stood, a short distance away from it, just silently saying my prayers in my head. So I wasn't carrying a poster, leaflets, Bible, rosary.
The centre was closed, so no one was even coming in or out.
The abortion centre was closed. There was no one there at all. And, you know, if anyone was looking at me, I could have been waiting for a taxi or, you know, whatever on the street corner. You know, I wasn't kneeling down with my hands clasped up to my chest or anything like that. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but I'm just saying, you know, as a statement of fact, that was all I was doing. And I presume some of the locals recognise me, know who I am, and phoned the police. And the police came and asked me if I was protesting. And I said, no, I wasn't protesting. And they said, what was I doing? And I said, well, you know, physically, I'm just standing here. I might be praying in my head, but, you know, if I was, it would just be silent prayers. And that was enough for them to tell me I was under arrest. So I hadn't even said I was praying. I said, I might be praying in my head. And they heavily searched me on the pavement, spent a long time going through my hair. I'm not quite sure what they were hoping to find there, evidence of prayer or something. And took me to the police station, locked me in a cell for quite a while, and then eventually questioned me and initially released on bail. And then I had to go to court a few months later.
And what happened at that court hearing? Were you...
So, yeah, when I went to court, I was completely acquitted within minutes. The prosecution didn't offer any evidence. In fact, they would barely seem to want to speak at all. I remember the judge actually saying, you know, she deserves to know why she's been brought here, but they just didn't seem to want to communicate. So obviously I was declared completely innocent. I was actually alongside a priest who was taken to court at the same time as me. He'd had a bumper sticker on the back of his car that said, "Unborn lives matter," and that had been parked in the buffer zone, something that he'd done many times before. It wasn't that he went to do it particularly because there was a buffer zone. He went to court as well and was acquitted on the same day as me. So having reasoned, okay, everyone understands that, you know, I am allowed to be there. And I should say, by the way, the charge was that I was engaging in an act which was intimidating service users. I mean, it just kind of highlights how ridiculous it was. There were no service users. The abortion centre was closed. So we can clearly see somebody just had a bit of an agenda that they were trying to be intimidating by intimidating me rather than the other way around of me intimidating anyone else.
Which of these topics has not been covered on PremierChristianity.com? UFOs, near-death experiences, Doctor Who, Christ's return, the faith of celebrities, and Andrew Tate. Trick question. We don't shy away from any topic. We cover faith as it affects us in daily life and give you the bigger picture. PremierChristianity.com. Special podcast subscription offer at PremierChristianity.com/podcast.
And so you decided, obviously, this meant that what you were doing were okay, and yeah, you did it again.
So it was a couple of weeks later, I went and stood in exactly the same spot. And again, nothing out loud, no posters or anything, just silently said some prayers there. This time, six police officers came with a van. And they told me that my prayers were an offence. And I remember saying, you know, these are silent prayers, making sure that they had understood the situation. I said, I'm not even saying anything out loud. And they said, it doesn't matter, your prayers are an offence.
Wow.
And taken away in a police van, again, put in a cell for a while before being released on bail. They didn't actually charge me that time. I was kept for waiting for 6 months before they told me that nothing was happening, which I think is the longest period of time that they can kind of keep things on hold for. And then after that, they would still come out with, you know, because I carried on going after that. They would come out and give me tickets and tell me that I was going to be fined. So it seemed to be like quite a process of intimidation, which is why I felt, you know, I really need to make a claim against the police because they're not stopping and they're carrying on in what I felt was being quite an intimidating manner towards me. So I made a claim against them for wrongful arrest, for false imprisonment, and for assault. And eventually I was awarded an out-of-court settlement of £13,000, which is kind of where we are up to date at the moment.
And since that point, have you been back? Have you prayed again? Has anything else happened?
I have been and prayed outside the abortion centre. I haven't had any response since then. But as many people will know, you know, that hasn't been the case for everybody in the country. Adam Smith Connor down in Bournemouth, he was accused of praying inside the abortion centre buffer zone there. Went to court because he didn't pay a fine, and it was upheld in court that he had to pay it. And he's appealing at the moment, and that's in the process of going ahead at the moment. But again, he was just silently saying some prayers in his head, a distance away from the abortion centre. Even had his back to it, behind a tree, and yet somehow it was deemed to, you know, to be breaking the PSPO. So we can see this is a you know an ongoing battle in some respects.
And how is this happening? Like, why is it that in one part of the country, I mean, you've had to go through this battle, but you were acquitted and you have received compensation, and yet someone else in another part of the country has been found guilty. Fairly similar sounding situations. What's the problem with how the law is being interpreted, or is it just not clear enough?
So one of the things I would say is that both myself and Adam were either arrested or fined, whatever, under PSPOs, not under the national law. And those PSPOs, the wording of them does vary from place to place. So there is five of those in the country: Birmingham, Manchester, two in London, and one in Bournemouth. And each of those will have different wording. It's not like the same, exactly the same. It's the same law, but the wording of that law will be different. So, for instance, in Bournemouth, it particularly mentions making the sign of the cross, which, you know, a lot of Catholics would feel was quite discriminatory towards them. In Birmingham, it talks about even words like mum, baby, fetus, soul, are things that you couldn't display in that area in connection to abortion. So, you know, they're quite specific rules for each area. So how that is interpreted will very much vary from place to place. And we've certainly had a big problem up till now with a lack of clarity in the law as to what is and what isn't allowed. With poor Adam Smith Connor, he actually, the week before he received his fine, he was there outside the abortion centre, and a police officer came up to him and actually said to him, "You're sailing close to the wind, but you're allowed to do what you're doing. This is England, you know, you're allowed to be here." So he was actually told, in fact, four times this police officer repeated himself, saying that you are entitled to do what you're doing. And yet the following week, you know, no new rule had come into place. He was given a fine. And it just seems to be whoever's interpreting it on the day can be the one who makes that, you know, makes that final decision, which is very, very confusing for many people.
I mean, and for many Christians, the whole idea that there are now certain parts of the UK where you are not able to pray is horrific in and of itself, regardless of the issue, regardless of where or why, just the fact that, you know, from a freedom of religion, freedom of expression, freedom of belief point of view, the idea that you cannot go here and say prayers out loud in a public space. If you'd have asked me 10 years ago, would this ever happen in the UK? I'd have said, absolutely not. What can the church do about it? What should we be doing about it?
I just think it is really important to highlight what you've just said. I think it's actually incredibly discriminatory. that we can see particularly Christians pro-life as being targeted by this. And for, I would say even for those who don't share that view or maybe don't understand why it's important for Christians to do this or to do that in that particular location, we should be able to see the discriminatory nature of these rules, that they're trying to stop somebody offering help. That's actually very patronising to women to say that they can't be offered help in those areas. And actually, an incredibly unjust situation where women who are in very difficult situations can't be offered that alternative, which doesn't get offered inside the abortion centre, in case anyone's under any illusions that when people go into the abortion centre, they'll be offered, help in continuing their pregnancy, financial help, babysitting, all the sorts of help that we might be able to offer and other groups who we work alongside with. So it is a very, very discriminatory law.
I think that's really important, actually. I think a lot of people, especially Christians who may not have had an abortion or had exposure to that kind of industry, a lot of the time, especially now when we see those placards, abortion is healthcare, these are private companies who are making a lot of profit out of abortion services, and it is not in their interests to discourage anyone at the end of the day from a profit point of view to consider another option, is it? And those it's not as if they're being offered secular objective counseling when they get in the door. So sometimes those Christian organizations or other faith-based organizations that offer pregnancy crisis counseling or funding or support may be the only option that someone who doesn't want an abortion or feels that abortion is their only option might receive.
I think that is a hugely important point, because someone like myself, like I say, for 20 years, I've been going outside abortion centres, 20 plus years. So I've spoken to many, many, hundreds and hundreds of women and couples, both before abortions, after abortions, those who are just considering it or thinking about it. And so many of them, when it gets to that question of, what is actually said in the abortion centre, what help are they offered? And I know myself, I went into an abortion centre many years ago, not for myself, I've never been pregnant, but just to see what the process was like. And it was as I had expected, that there wasn't help and alternatives being offered. It's simply a track that you get on. And once you get on that, it's pointing in a certain way. I remember talking to one woman, and she told me, in fact, she shared her story publicly, so she doesn't mind this being shared. Her name's Amrita. Her story's on the March for Life website. She actually was considering an abortion, but she wasn't sure. And she went to the abortion centre with her list of questions, because that was, something which would help her decide whether this was a decision that she wanted to make or not. And she asked her first question. I think it was something like, does the baby have a heartbeat or something like that? And the abortion centre said to her, it's as simple as this. Do you want an abortion or not? And so she ended up agreeing and taking the abortion pill and then immediately regretting it. Thankfully, she managed to find, how she could get reversal for that, which again isn't something that the abortion centre would direct you to or help you to find. It was through the amazing Dr. Dermot Kearney, who's a doctor who helped her get progesterone to try and reverse the effects of the abortion pill. But if it was up to the abortion centre, she would have just continued and very likely lost that child. And so many women say similar things that, even if they do ask specific questions at the abortion centre or do ask to see a scan, abortion centres will know that if they see the scan, that there might be a likelihood that that could actually, encourage that woman to continue a pregnancy. So we can see that that's not in the nature of their business. Their business is making money from abortions. They don't make any money from women who choose life. And that can affect the advice and help that they're any, I hate to say help or service, because I don't think that they're giving a service to anyone or help to anyone, but anything that they're providing can be affected by that.
Yeah. So I want to go back to something you said right towards the beginning of the interview, and you said you grew up in a home where you were instinctively pro-life because you felt that that was what all children are. We grow up with this instinctive value for life. I have two teenage girls. I've been through a UK state education system. Do you feel that that has changed at all over the last few decades? Are we still, as a society, instinctively pro-life?
I still think from a young child that our natural instinct is to care for life. And I think it's it's very subtle, the ways that our society teaches us otherwise. And so I think if parents, for instance, don't help their child to understand this issue, and certainly if they're in, you know, just general education, then I think by the time they get to be a teenager, it's very likely that they might have different opinions on this subject because of the media, because of education, and you know, even how language talks about this subject, it's incredibly subtle, the sort of propaganda that can be got over. So for instance, I mean, I was talking to a couple a while ago, they would certainly describe themselves as being very pro-life Christian couple that actually helped out with the work that I do. And they came and said to me, "Oh, Isabel, would you pray for our daughter? You know, there's a risk that her baby could have Down syndrome." You know, and I said, "Of course I'll pray for your daughter. But I don't think children with Down syndrome are a risk." And they just stopped for a minute and they went, "I can't believe it. We're repeating the language that the NHS has been using to our daughter. We don't think that children with Down syndrome are a risk either." You know, and just something as simple as that, you know, that there's a, you know, there's a danger or a risk. And, you know, the same, like there's a risk your child might have a heart defect. You know, your child might not be perfect. This isn't something we can say that there's a chance or there's a possibility that your child might have Down syndrome. That's a much fairer way of looking at it rather than all the sort of negative connotations that were put on it. And equally, people will talk about, you know, have you protected yourself against pregnancy, you know, when they're talking about contraception. So pregnancy is some sort of disease that needs to be protected from. Again, we're encouraging people to look at pregnancy and children in a negative light. And that can affect decisions that people make, because then the natural consequence of a, you know, a physical relationship, which, you know, can be to have a child, can become some sort of unintended, unexpected, you know, result. So the amount of people I've spoken to outside abortion centres who said to me, "I've got no idea how this happened." And obviously, on one level, they do. But what they mean is, you know, because they were using contraception, sometimes two forms of it, they had no idea that that could fail, you know, and it's considered a failure that they're now pregnant rather than something beautiful. And don't get me wrong, of course, it can be very challenging bringing up children. It can be, you know, an initial shock if you're not expecting to be pregnant and you are, but still recognizing the beauty of every individual life, which is something that we really fail to see in modern life nowadays. Children are just looked on purely in terms of sort of cost and burden and how my life will change, which I'm not saying these are things that don't affect us, but it's to purely say that a child or a human being is only looked at in that terms, because I'd hate somebody to look at me and say, what does Isabel cost society? You know, what sort of a burden is she on those around them? You know, if you know, we can see that with the assisted suicide bill, that we are doing that now with, you know, adults or those who are, you know, maybe suffering or older, that suddenly it's all in terms of costs. We can't do that with human beings. Certainly not if we're godly people. If we really recognize this is something that raises us above the animals, that we have souls and we're made in the image and likeness of God.
Often it's portrayed as well as a positive, isn't it? You know, to, you know, my two girls would certainly say that what they hear from within their own peer group a lot of the time is that women have a right to choose, that this is part of our liberation. This enables us to control how many children we have. It enables us to take control of our careers. It's part of moving out of the patriarchy and all. And some of those things, those half-truths, are really good and positive, aren't they? That there is a truth that, you know, we do have a right to self-determination. But when you hear people talk about and the same with assisted dying, I have a right to choose the end of my life, I want to die with dignity, I want to be out of pain, of course, those all seem like very reasonable, compassionate things, and they're dressed up as compassion. And then suddenly we're moving into this strange era where the church is considered the uncompassionate ones, because we're suggesting something that might affect people's autonomy, that it might be costly towards them. How do you change that narrative?
Well, I think you said a really key word amongst all that, which was half-truths. And I think that is very much how Satan works. And I just think it's just really important to highlight that, because I think so often we're just unaware. We'll see something like you say, dying with dignity. Oh, that sounds good. Of course, I think I should die with dignity and live with dignity while I'm alive, as though somehow allowing God to choose our time and place of death is not dignified. That if we're in pain, suddenly we lose our dignity. That if that suffering somehow takes away dignity. So I think yes, we do very much need to recognize the half truths that Satan is telling us all the time. But that being said, I think maybe when we're looking at younger people and the questions that, well, maybe particularly younger people, because that's when the questions will first come up surrounding these issues of life. But it applies to all ages. A lot of people will have very genuine and important questions about these issues. What about if a woman has been raped and becomes pregnant? Or what about if her child has got a life-limiting condition? And it's questions that are very much deserve answers and need answers. And the problem is, I think sometimes these people, at the, you know, whether it's a teenager who's asking these questions for the first time, or somebody later on who's suddenly having to face a situation that's affecting them personally, they're not getting good answers. They're not getting good answers from the church. They're not getting good answers from teachers. Even sometimes from their parents, and sometimes parents with the best will in the world don't know how to answer those questions adequately. They might feel, yes, I don't feel abortion is the right thing, but how do I explain that to a child? Or how do I explain that to my friend? How do I articulate my views? And I think this is something that is really, really, really important. We need to be able to explain properly why we believe what we believe. And that's something certainly as Christians that we need to be very much aware of. So I think, just something that I think is quite important for people to maybe reflect on is when they're looking at all those difficult situations that can come up that maybe make people think, oh, is abortion something that I should be doing, or is it something that I, should be allowed to be doing in this situation? I think before you start looking at all those kind of hard cases that we might call them, we need to go back first and start at the beginning. And the beginning is this, is what does it mean to be pregnant? Because ultimately, if you and the person that you're talking to, if you were maybe trying to explain this to a child or to a friend, if you have different ideas on what pregnancy is and what it means to be pregnant, then you're never going to have the same conclusion as to what can be done with that pregnancy. If I think it's a human being and the person I'm talking to thinks it's merely a blob of tissue, well, of course we can treat that very differently. So I think, help people to understand that they have to start at the beginning, which is what is pregnancy? What does it mean to be pregnant? And I think that answer is actually written on all of our hearts. We've covered it up with a lot of lies and misinformation. So for instance, a while ago, I was at an event, a Christian event, and somebody, I had a stall there for my March for Life organization that I run, and somebody, a teenager came up to me and said, I would never go to one of your events. I think if somebody was raped, became pregnant, she should be allowed to have an abortion. And I said, this is a really important point to discuss. But in order to do it justice, I think we need to go back and look at, to start with, what does it mean to be pregnant? What would your thoughts be on that? And she said to me, well, I think it would mean that there'd be something inside you. And I said, very true. But I've got something inside me and I'm not pregnant. So what's the difference between me and somebody who's pregnant? And she said, okay, well, there'd be cells inside you. And again, I said, okay, I've got cells inside me, but I'm not pregnant. So what would be the difference? And she said, okay, human cells. Now, I was beginning to wonder what sort of cells she thought I had inside me, but I held my tongue on that and just said, again, I've got human cells inside me, but I'm not pregnant. So what's the difference between what's inside me and what's inside somebody who's pregnant? And after a long pause, she went, okay, they'd be having a baby. So I didn't have to tell her that. She knew that, but she just needed some help uncovering it because she just heard so many of these sayings that we hear from the from those who support abortion of, oh, it's a clump of cells, and those kind of little trite maxims that people come out with. And we're not actually thinking about, well, what do I really think? It's just a clump of cells. She knew that it was more than that because, like I say, myself and her both had cells inside of us, but we didn't have a child, a human being inside of us. So I think it's helping people to uncover that truth that they know, but in a way that isn't aggressive, it's not argumentative, So hopefully before you've got stuck into some big argument, right at the beginning, help to set the scene by just simply asking somebody, what is pregnancy? What does it mean to be pregnant? And then you can look at, well, what does abortion do to that human being? You know, and again, that's at that time, you're not apportioning any moral value to that human being, but just together you're or any moral value to abortion. But it's just to start with saying, what is pregnancy and what does abortion do to that? And then once you've understood that, then you're in a much better place to look at the situation of rape or what if my child's not perfect like I thought they were going to be and things like that, which are real questions that need to be addressed, but only in light of those facts, which, as I say, I think we all know in our hearts, but sometimes need to articulate them for ourselves to hear.
They are really good points, aren't they? And I would love to ask you that. What is your answer? What about rape? Like what when we have those difficult conversations, especially with perhaps non-Christian friends who say, well, that's unreasonable of you to expect someone who has been through something unimaginable that I can't imagine and you can't imagine, to then, you know, have to give birth to a child that they don't want and that comes with such a horrendous source of pain. I think there's a feeling from non-Christians that by saying we are pro-life as Christians, that we are passing a judgment on people who do not share our beliefs or enforcing our beliefs on people who don't share our beliefs. How do we get around that? How do we communicate that well with grace?
Yeah, and like I say, I do think you need to start at the beginning. So sometimes people will become, you know, almost defensive when they get a question like that. And I've heard people shoot back answers like, oh, well, that's just, you know, less than 1% of all the abortions. And I'm not saying that's not true. And maybe that's something that does need to be looked at, you know, as to why they're particularly picking that rather than the, you know, 99% of abortions, which are done for more social reasons. But that is real to somebody, you know, and why knock the person that you're talking to? That might be something that's in their past, even if they haven't become pregnant through that. They might have been through the horrific, traumatic experience of rape, which I can't begin to imagine what that would be like. Or maybe somebody close to them does. Maybe they just have a real heart for women who've been through that. And that's a good thing. So I think, you know, pro-lifers do need to be wary of sort of dismissing somebody who's asking a genuine question, even if they're maybe asking it in a slightly provocative way. It's a genuine question and it deserves a real answer. And I think my starting point would be with that person, like I say, initially to help them go back and look at what is pregnancy, what does abortion do to that child once we've understood it's a child and a human being. And then in light of that, we can look at, you know, pregnancy through rape. Okay. So and I think sometimes just giving a bit of a story to help illustrate it can be helpful. And I would say, by the way, I know people who've been through that and been through rape, become pregnant through rape and had an abortion. And sometimes the reason they've said they've had an abortion is because this was what was expected of them by other people. And so I think even those who support abortion do need to be very wary of that, because people can feel pressured like, well, no one will believe I was raped if I say I want to keep the baby. You know, that just sounds so ridiculous that, you know, in the eyes of you know, the modern views of things, that if I say, yes, I recognise that the humanity of this child, and I'd like to continue the pregnancy, then people are going to think, well, you can't really have been raped. You know, so we do need to be very, very careful of that. But I remember hearing a story once, and it was a true story, and it was of a couple who were for years had been trying to conceive their child, to conceive a baby, and no luck. And one evening, tragically, this woman was raped, and she then became pregnant, and she went to the doctor and had you know, a checkup, and the doctor said, you know, yes, this pregnancy is a result of the rape, you know, you're whatever it is, you know, 8 weeks pregnant or whatever. And she and her husband spoke together and said, you know, we can't continue this pregnancy, you know. And she had an abortion. When she had the abortion, they then came back and said to her, I'm really sorry, we do need to tell you, we misdated your baby. It wasn't 8 weeks, it was more than that. And that meant, of course, it couldn't have been a product of the rape. It couldn't have been a child conceived through rape. This was actually their much wanted baby that they'd been trying to conceive for years, that they had aborted. And I think just sometimes looking at a story like that, it helps us see this was the same child inside her. And just simply the virtue of who the father was, we suddenly apportion a different value to that child. I also look at another beautiful story I know of a woman who went through the most horrific, brutal rape imaginable, very nearly died through it. And she conceived afterwards. And she was actually alone at the time when she found out that she was pregnant. And she phoned up her husband and said to him, that she was pregnant and it was from the rape. And when talking to him about not wanting a rapist baby, he said, "This is our baby. I'm your husband, and this will be our child." And he said, "That's always how I've looked at my son." And I just thought, isn't that what we need in the world? Good men like that, and women who can also recognize that as well, that doesn't, even if they felt they were unable to look after the child themselves. And of course, that's not nothing to be expected of them, or certainly nothing to feel any shame about if you feel that you couldn't look after that child. But to apportion the blame of a father onto a son or daughter, that's not, if you had a child who was, 2 years old, and they were they'd been conceived through rape, we wouldn't then think it was acceptable to take the life of that child. And if you look at that story that I shared of the couple who tragically aborted the child because they thought it was through rape and it wasn't, if you imagine another story, and obviously that was a true story, but if you imagine another story the opposite way around, if she'd become pregnant and the doctor had said, "Oh no, this is your husband's child," and so they continued the pregnancy, had the baby, and then maybe the baby suddenly took on features of the man who'd raped her. If they said, "Oh, actually, sorry, we misdiagnosed the situation, and yes, actually, this child, is from the rape," after the birth, we wouldn't say, "Oh, it was okay then to take the life of that child," because maybe he, th this little son, reminds you of the rapist when you look at him. The answer still isn't to take the life of that child. It might be that you feel you really can't look after that child, or well, maybe that child might help you to heal. Who knows? But we still can't apportion the blame of the rapist onto the child. And that's not to say that it becomes easy for that woman. It might be, in very likely, it will be a very, very difficult and traumatic experience. But taking the life of her child isn't the answer to it. And I think it comes back to that kind of clinching point of in our society nowadays, do we think that taking somebody's life, intentionally taking an innocent life, can that really be the answer to any problem? And surely that has to be no. Even if it means that something that we have to live with is very difficult, and sadly in our broken world there are sometimes very difficult things that we have to deal with, we still can't go taking other people's lives to try and make our problems better.
So I'd like to go back now and hear a little bit about how you got to the point where you are now. You're the director of March for Life. There's probably many other things that you're involved with. What happened to move you from going to your local abortion center and praying outside silently every now and again to suddenly being probably one of the most prominent activists in the UK at the moment, on the Christian pro-life sort of world? Tell us what you do now and how you got there.
Yeah, so when I initially went outside the abortion centre, I remember it was quite a surreal experience, looking at this being it was actually the first abortion centre open in the country that I was praying outside, and they did about 10,000 abortions a year.
How long ago would this have been?
This was about 20 years ago, maybe a bit more than that. I remember one of the people who was in that group who prayed there, they pointed up to the window and said, "That's where the abortions actually happened." And it was a beautiful old building in an extremely expensive residential street, this lovely leafy street, very attractive. And like I say, it was very surreal in as much as, to think behind those doors or in that particular room I'm looking at, 10,000 human beings every year are intentionally killed at their most vulnerable stage. And yet life is carrying on as normal. Students were walking past up to the university, people were just carrying on with their business who lived nearby, and you know, it was a busy street. And that really affected me, you know. And I have to say, on that very first day, I felt a really, really great sense of peace. Now, that might sound a really strange thing to say, considering what I've just said, that I was standing in front of a prolific abortion centre. If prolific is the right word for something so awful. But I felt I was where God wanted me to be. And I felt that sense of peace in myself, that this is where God wants me, you know. And I had to kind of foster that. It wasn't something that just sort of hit me so hard that, you know, I could sort of, you know, God was saying to me, this is what you must do. I rarely have those kind of experiences in my life. I know some people do, but it was something that I had to sort of foster myself. And, you know, I know for quite a few of the first times that I came outside that abortion centre, I didn't see anything dramatic happening. Sometimes it would have even been closed. Sometimes, you know, no opportunities to offer help to people or to talk to people. But gradually I began to see the difference that we made, and God worked on my heart and really helped to open it up. And like I say, I began to realise more, not just the injustice to the preborn child, the massive injustice to women, and also how men were affected as well. You know, sometimes you'd see men like on their knees begging a wife or girlfriend to continue a pregnancy. Sometimes you'd see men, you know, almost physically pushing women, you know, against their will to go and have an abortion. You'd see terrible situations there. And it really began to kind of work on my heart. And at that time, initially, it was just a very slightly disorganized group of people. They were lovely people, but, you know, it was just a handful of people who'd go there on a Saturday. And I heard about 40 Days for Life, which had started in America, and it was at that time came to London. And so after a few years, once 40 Days for Life came to London, I began to think maybe we could bring this to Birmingham and, you know, bring a bit more structure to our group. But I have to say, the thought of filling 12 hours a day, 7 days a week for 40 days with volunteers who would come and pray and offer help, I just thought, how on earth could I do that? You know, I probably knew maybe 10 people who might be able to help, you know. And I remember somebody saying to me, don't limit God. You know, you might not know how you're going to do this, but if you really feel it's what God wants you to do, you owe it to him to at least try, you know. So I did everything that I could. And it was really, really hard work. I remember having a ridiculously high phone bill at the end of that from the amount of people I contacted, you know. But every single hour of those 40 days, we had, you know, volunteers there who were praying and offering help. And I remember on my first day that I was there as part of that campaign, I remember a young woman, a sort of teenager, about 18, 19, walking past on the other side of the road. And she called over to me and said, you know, what are you doing there? And I explained to her that, you know, we were here to offer help, alternatives to anyone who was considering abortion. And she just said to me, why weren't you here last week? She said, if you were here last week, I wouldn't have had my abortion. Mm-hmm. And that kind of sat with me. And I thought, nobody else this campaign is going to be able to say that. Everybody is at least going to be offered an opportunity to continue their pregnancy, whether they choose to accept it or not. That's their free will. But I'm going to make sure everyone is offered that. And that's really kind of been the mission that we've had with our 40 Days for Life, as well as courses offering help to those who've had the abortion and might be hurting afterwards.
Amen. Thank you so much, Isabel, for your time today and for sharing all of your experience and wisdom with us. If anyone is listening today that wants to get more involved, that wants to find out more about March for Life or 40 Days for Life or any of the other things that you're involved in, or if they're a church leader perhaps and and something that you said earlier has sparked a little thing in them, they're like, you know what, we don't talk about this in our church enough, I don't know how to, where do I start, where can people go to get some resources?
So I would say that with March for Life, so we've got a website, marchforlife.co.uk, and we're more than just a march. So we do an annual march in the first Saturday of September. So that's the 6th of September next year, Saturday. But we do other things throughout the year. And one of those things, for instance, that we do is training days for those who work in the church, particularly for pastors, for priests, you know, clergy in the church, you know, any people who are working in the sort of ministerial positions, to help them either to learn how to talk about that issue, maybe if particularly to help them to talk about those who've been affected by abortion, and to be able to minister effectively to those who've been hurt by abortion, and maybe just how to make their churches a pro-life church and a welcoming church to people who've been affected by abortion. So we do training days for that. If somebody is interested in that, contact us. There's a section on our website that explains a little bit about that. We also do days called Rethink Abortion Days, which are interactive days where people can come along and learn how to talk effectively about abortion in their everyday life. You know, so many people I talk to, they might say they've come on the March for Life, but they still don't know how to talk to their family or to their flatmates or whoever else it might be about abortion. We can help you with these different things. So get in touch at marchforlife.co.uk.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.